Okay, hi everybody, and welcome to episode 125 of the Alexis Sale podcast. The 125 Britain's first high speed train. Yeah, 125 miles an hour.
Which camera do we look at? There's so many.
That's on Barry. This is on all of yours, and that's on you too.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So we're doing something different. We're in a pub called the Bill Murray in Islington. The reason we're doing this is when I look up my own podcast on YouTube to read the comments and revel in the viewing figures.
Mm.
A thousand, 2,000. The algorithm offers me a much more successful podcast that I've become fascinated by, which is called Barry's Economics. And it's a guy called Barry. And what he does is, the ones I've noticed anyway, the ones the algorithm has pushed at me, is I know more about him now because I'm sitting in his front room. But I mean, what it has always seemed to me, and I've thought about this a lot, is that, as a Marxist, you see the struggle for liberation in a way kind of governed by these laws of economics. But I think I've always felt that that only provides part of the story. And given that human society springs from the minds of people, springs from all our psychologies, unless as long as you discount existentialist religion or any of that nonsense, everything, all the struggles that we're involved in spring from the minds of individuals, both individuals who are wicked and, genocidal or capitalistic or whatever, but also obviously individuals who want to resist those impulses. So, and what it seems to me Barry's Economics does is he brings a psychological, a much needed kind of psychological analysis to the business of challenging capitalism, really. And so I was really impressed with that. I think it's much needed, and it should be part of what we do. So here I am, and here's Barry. Hi, Barry.
Thanks, mate.
I don't even know your surname, actually.
Ferns.
Barry Ferns, right. But also we found out after Talal locked him up that he also runs the Bill Murray, that runs the Angel Comedy Club.
Yeah.
So I was doing good work on several fronts. So I don't know. Tell me about tell us about your podcast, really, and the work, where that knowledge comes from. I the latest one I saw you talking about a Moffley, is that right?
Yeah.
Which is it was done partly as Rory Stewart, and I was just saying, like I said on my radio program, don't think he's nice just because he looks like a monkey. Rory Stewart interviewed Gary Zapolansky and adopted this kind of Oscar Wilde kind of horror at the fact that that Zapolansky was for his economic advice was going to people like Grace Blakely and Gary Stevens and wasn't going to all these noted fucking establishment economists and then had an attack of the vapors on his own podcast with Alistair Campbell. Alistair Campbell talks movingly about his depression on Panorama.
An attack of the vapors.
It's kind of Victorian. You referenced a lot of research which kind of proves that if you just get people who all think the same way as establishment economists do, then they will all come up with the wrong answer. I mean, and you see this in a sense. I mean, to slightly jump the rails. I mean, one of the reasons that the Labour Party has been, under Keir Starmer, has been so ineffective is because it's composed entirely of people who think along very narrow lines, which is pro-capitalist, pro-Israel, and hates the left, and that's about all that they've got. And so they can't they can't come up with innovative solutions to problems because they're hampered by this kind of groupthink. So anyway, tell me about where your knowledge comes from, you know, and can I get a gig at the comedy club?
You can gig here 24/7. I'd be like, this wouldn't be here without you, honestly. Even that is an example. So, I think a lot of my experience in life is that a lot of the things that inform our lives are invisible to us. You know, it's like you will have influenced and made it possible for hundreds of thousands of comedians to do what they do. And yet they wouldn't know that's the case because we can't see a direct kind of line between one person's actions and another person, the effects, and it ripples out in that way. And I think the reason why I'm obsessed with the psychological and how I got versed in it is purely because I started stand-up when I was 15. I come from a working class family that literally I'm one of 36 cousins or like nobody in my family had gone to university until I went to university. I was lucky enough to pass the 11 plus. But like I know, so like my family are so intelligent, so such good people, and yet they just never. It wasn't in the language of the family or their experience to go to university. Mm. And like, and I know so many people from where I grew up. Like my brother's got 4 kids, and he cleans cars for a living, and that's what he does. He's a great guy, and he does it, and he does it brilliantly, and he does it well. But within the culture that I then went to when I was in university, it was their lives are in some ways lower. In a lot of people, you do that. Why'd you do that?
Yeah.
But what I never, it took me years to understand. So I went to university. When I left university, I went back to work at Burger King because I'd been working at Burger King beforehand, but it didn't occur to me that I could get a different job because what was familiar with me was like working at the pork pie factory in the summer, working at Burger King. I've worked in all the fast food restaurants, Burger King, KFC, McDonald's. I've done them all. Burger King's the best place to work. I'd never worked at Wimpy.
Uh-huh. Where was that? Where did you go?
So Paul in Dorset, right? And the thing that stopped me, and that's a good example, the Burger King thing after university, because the psychology stopped me progressing.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the time we don't understand because the waters we swim in when we grow up, like the psychological waters we swim in that hamper our expectations, or if you try and you fail so many times because you've not got a safety net, you just believe you're not good enough.
Yeah.
And so I started stand-up when I was 15, and went to university pretty much just to be near London to do stand-up.
Which one?
I went to University of Surrey, Twickenham, and, I then spent 10 years trying to do comedy and taking shows to the Edinburgh Festival. I got into debt. I ended up bankrupt. I ended up homeless. I ended up squatting. And then literally I knew that I was good and I was able to do stuff in the room and I was getting good reviews and it just for some reason didn't happen. And so you either go mad or you decide not to do comedy anymore or you try and figure out why. And it's very easy to get bitter and go, oh, the world's like this or the world's like that. But the way that I went was towards the psychological. And so really understanding, what other factors are there other than just the financial one, like the safety net and me not having that opportunity? Because I realized very early that privilege isn't just the privilege of having enough money or the house. Privilege is the privilege to be able to fail and it be able
to. I remember what came born home to me years ago. There was a guy called George Melly.
George Melly?
Yeah, he was a jazz singer. He was an old Etonian, wealthy, came from a wealthy background, I think on the Wirral near Liverpool. Couldn't sing at all. I mean, he was just absolutely open. And yet he had a career as a jazz musician just because of his confidence. But he also had a biography that I read.
It was jazz be a vocal thing. It was just like, I just make up the notes vocally. Just like,
But at least he could actually sing. He couldn't. It's just shit. He was completely shit.
Like Forrest Jenkins.
Yeah, Forrest Jenkins.
They made
Jenkins.
A movie about
But anyway, I remember reading his autobiography, which was called Rum, Bum and Concertina, which is about, I think it's a posh, it's the version of, it's something to do with the Navy. I can't remember. But anyway, he talks about, I think, being at Eton, and he talks about, you know, I was at school, in my class was the, you know, the historian R.F. Fortescue and the physician, you know, J.B. Bonkins. And I thought, no, you can't, not the, oh, you're in a class of people who are just good at physics or are good at history, like I was. But because of their expectations and the confidence, they will go on to become the famous historian or the famous physicist. And yeah, the people I was, you know, school with, if they're lucky, go on to be probation officers.
Yeah. It's the phrase, yeah, if you can see it, you can be it.
Right.
And that works so on so many different levels. Like, not just with having female superheroes now, then now women are like, oh, I could become that. I mean, even that's relatively new. Mm. Just that kind of thing. But even, like, you just don't see how pernicious it is. It's like you don't, it doesn't even occur to you that you can become, like, it didn't occur to me, like, that I could do certain things. It not even on the table. When, obviously, somebody else that had seen their uncle or...
Yeah.
Why don't you just go and do that?
And the connections as well.
And those kind of things are also true.
I knew that. Sorry, I knew this very posh bloke once in Banbury. I think he went to either one. It's called Teddy. And he said, when I was a young lad, when I was young, and my father said to me, he said, what would you fancy doing, Teddy? And I said, I think I'd like to be a spy. And they said, well, all right, I'll ask your Uncle Gerald. He runs that. So I had Uncle Gerald took me out to lunch at the Garrick Club, you know, or, you know, Boodles. And we had a lovely lunch, you know. And then afterwards he said, no, I don't think so, Teddy. I just love that. Your Uncle Gerald, he runs.
He runs about five. But that, all those kind of things, what's interesting is that when somebody is like that, they only see from your own perspective. It's called the fundamental attribution error, where you can only see things from your own perspective. And they can see that they did hard work. They know they worked hard. So from their position, when something happens for them, it's a meritocracy. I've worked hard. I have an ability. Now, it doesn't mean that, I mean, it's kind of relatively rare that somebody has no ability whatsoever and is in a position, but it does happen. Yeah. But certainly.
I think Labour Cabinet's full of them.
But most people think that life is a meritocracy because the people that are in power have actually, it's called survivorship bias, have actually been shown to that they're, that their knowledge, their actions, their talent has been rewarded. So from their position, it's a meritocracy. And it's totally true. It looks like that's totally true from their position. But they don't see.
And you can't blame someone for using the resources at their, exactly, at their fingertips.
Which is why being actually angry at them is almost like, I think, can be quite unhelpful because you entrench them in their position. So actually just looking at the science is one of the reasons why I'm really interested in science, because it depersonalizes it. Mm. And suddenly like, oh, well, these are psychological and scientific and neurological facts. And it's like you are going to be biased in that situation. And so therefore, if you can accept the facts of that, which are biological facts, you can't get out of it. And suddenly it's not a matter of discussing you deserve this when you don't deserve this. It's like, and we need to make sure that we create a different system so that the people that don't survive, which are the vast majority or in their chosen career, there's actually support for them in different ways. And so it changes the conversation. And I think that's so, I find it very heartening because like often it can become entrenched in, I've got this, you've got that. And then suddenly it's like, it's a personal argument rather than it being a kind of purely practical, dry, analytical argument about how structures work. Yeah.
You were saying earlier that you
sorry, I ended up on a kind of let.
That's the show. Don't worry. You were saying that you couldn't see yourself doing something, but you were doing it. You were doing stand up, and even through homelessness and living in squats. So what is it that you were missing? What is it that was wrong?
Don't take an inability to imagine anything else as a ability. Like, but I am a survivor, and I say that in a very, like, I know so many amazing comedians. I mean, you will as well. You both will. That were brilliant and just got a bit unlucky. And like, I wasn't lucky. I got kind of bankrupt, homeless, whatever, but I managed to stay in it. And sometimes that's just enough just to keep going. And there's, you know, like, this is a, thankfully, perseverance is a great substitute for talent. Is it? So, I don't know, quite. But like, really, I'm just lucky enough. And I absolutely believe this. Luck is so fundamentally sourced or unreferenced as a reason for success. Yeah. And it's not to say that people shouldn't try. Often you say if something's lucky, it's like, oh, what's the point trying? No, you have to try as well.
Yeah.
But luck is a huge part of being able to afford to live or, you know, and I've done so many temp jobs over the years and I've struggled and I wouldn't want anyone to have my life. Right now, you could look at me and you go, oh, this guy's a success. I haven't had a family. I could never afford a family. I don't own a house. I live upstairs in a flat share. I kind of like, you know, I'm not kind of, but what I mean is like the struggle itself can sometimes be kind of, I know so many people that are just like spent 20, 30 years struggling. And it's like the everyday paper cuts of just surviving.
Yeah.
It's like, so really there's no magic formula. It's just like, I just managed to stay standing. I look like Rocky in the ring, you know, like when it just not stupid enough to fall down. That's purely it. It's like, you know, Rocky, protect your face. No.
Yeah. It was even charming.
How they do.
So how did you set about acquiring this psychological knowledge that you have?
Well, reading. So I did a foundation and first year in psychotherapy. I also did kind of a lot of reading in. This was at Birkbeck. So I went to Birkbeck and did a foundation course. One of the good things about being unemployed when I was unemployed is that they would help you with training. So I ended up doing some training there in counseling and psychotherapy and therapy. And I kind of read a lot around that from then. And it's also just been a personal obsession because I always say that my obsession with kind of like psychotherapy or reframing things led to me being able to get myself out of the gutter, you know, like of just being able to kind of pull myself up out of the hopelessness or the learned helplessness that comes when you fucked up too many times and you're in the gutter and you don't know how to get out, you know? So it was really a survival strategy as much as anything else, just like trying to understand the why. You know, like you must have that in your life where you've got like, you just go, I'm here again. How did I end up in this position again? Like every single time, right? You're just like, when am I going to learn this lesson?
I was having a bit of an existential crisis while you were talking about privilege before. Because I've been given every privilege. Despite being a child of immigrants and my dad.
Your sibling, was, right?
So yeah. And my dad was doing three jobs. Worked his fucking ass off and started from nothing, with no contacts, nothing, and then ends up being pretty high level in his game. You know, he was a journalist.
Yeah.
And so I was born with so much privilege. I was given opportunities galore. Like my family friend is the first Arab barrister.
Wow.
And so I went, did work experience in his office. Michelle Abdel Masih.
Wow.
My dad got me a meeting with the head of comedy at BBC. This was a long time ago, before I knew what to do with it all. Yeah. My dad got me work experience at like a NBC Middle Eastern Broadcasting Center. Like fucking so many opportunities. And I just kept coming home, just not making anything of it. And like striking out and not really knowing what to do, feeling out of place. And my dad's like, what would I do with you?
I'd say that everyone has privileges, right?
Yeah.
But I would say that you also psychologically would have had other things. Like to be a child of first generation immigrants, right? You would have absolutely had certain psychological things that might have actually gotten in the way of going doing certain things, or you know, you might have felt pressure from your family to actually meet these people or whatever. Like
maybe it was just a rebelliousness against my dad trying to get me to be productive, and I just want to. I was a very late bloomer in terms of maturity and responsibility. So,
I'm still hoping I'm going to be a late.
I mean, I suppose one of the things that the British ruling class has done is to iron out those. Yeah, I mean, your background was very bumpy. It was privileged in some ways, but it was also very bumpy in other ways, really. But the British ruling class, they do. There'll be one kid in four who completely goes off the rails, whether it becomes a drug addict or whatever. But I mean, they've kind of ironed out, kind of by the natural selection or conscious thought, that their children will move seamlessly into positions of power that they feel.
Well, I think that's true. But I also think that's, like, that's the kind of structural thing of, like, if you've got enough money, if there's a problem, you look at it. If you've got kind of like, if you went to certain schools, you just happen to know the people around.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you can fail upwards. Yeah. It is possible to fail upwards.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can actually be, and it's interesting as well, because people can be a fuck up. And like, but career wise, not.
Yeah.
Like, you know, some people, they're just absolute drunks, absolute abusers, absolute whatever. And what would get them sacked in another position won't get them sacked in there because they happen to know the person that runs the company or other structural things. So people can look like successes, but actually they're kind of, you know, that it's just purely from the outside. Internally, like, who was it? I was at a funeral a couple of months ago, and I met somebody that was at university, and they were all the success at university. And, you know, really kind of a bit of a bully, but really kind of, you know, somebody that I thought had everything together. But I was talking to him, and it was like just a moment of reframing, because it was just, he was divorced, not talking to his wife, hadn't seen his kids for 2 years, and like just was drunk and couldn't stop drinking. And just like, man, like, sometimes people can look like a success. And I'm glad I didn't choose to swap lives then, because like they're going somewhere else, you know. It was I always.
So how have you? I mean, so you acquired this psychological knowledge, and then how have you set about applying it, as it were? Really, I mean, just through the podcast. Yeah. Is it called Barry's Economics and Mockery of Gary's Economics?
There's no mockery.
No, you're quite complimentary of Gary.
Yeah.
So I used to have, one of the things that I used to say on stage, I used to have a joke about the name Barry, right? So the name Barry is pretty much a shit name, is it? It's a punchline. Barry's a punchline, isn't it? Yeah. You know? Like if Barry's from EastEnders, you know, you've got, and I used to say all of the Ari names are rubbish. Like, if you invite a party and who's going to be there? Well, Barry, Gary, and Larry. It's not a party yet. But then there's one, what's interesting is there's one Ari name that is good. Like, it's Harry.
Harry.
Because that's where the money is. Like, Harry's, like, and it's interesting because culturally, you can see the Harry's as a successful name. Because where are the Harry's? You've got Prince Harry, you've got Harry Styles, you've got the film Dirty Harry. And you know, just from the name of that film, that's a cool film about a cool person, right? Yeah. A film called Dirty Barry. that's not a cool film, is it?
No.
That's a documentary, isn't it?
No.
It's a terrifying documentary that you don't want to have starred in. Like, it's like, so when I kind of like, I started watching Gary's Economics, and in my head, I just thought, you know, because he's so competent, he's so like across everything, he grew up in kind of like a tough environment, ended up as a millionaire trader, and it's like, he's a success. And I was just like, it'd be quite funny just to do a Barry's Economics, which is like, it's total failure. Just like, it's Barry's Economics, you know. And it amused me because I was like, yeah, it's Barry's and Gary's. And then I thought about it more, and I was just doing my Edinburgh show last year, which is essentially about my journey, which is how kind of from doing stand-up 15 years, from the age of 15, like going bankrupt and all of that. And so that was in my head. And then I thought the Barry's Economics, I thought, you know, there is something about talking, because Gary talks about it. I think one of the reasons why Gary's channel works is because he's a millionaire, multimillionaire, talking about redistribution. It gives him authority to talk about it. And I was like, this is a successful guy. Maybe actually.
And he's approachable. He's approachable
for all the other reasons as well, because he's brilliant and really good at communicating. But this, it gives him a badge of authority. And then I thought, actually, you know what? There's something to talking about economics, like behavioral economics, from if you failed. So from the bottom, looking up, you know, like all of those things. Because actually, a lot of people are really struggling just to survive, like even psychologically. So it came from that, really. It really did come from Gary's Economics. And Gary had just done a shout out saying, oh, we need more people talking about like this kind of stuff in the space, in the media space, because there's a lot of funding, as you're right, Ben. And there's not on the left. And while I don't necessarily ascribe to left wing, right wing, because I actually think it's not helpful and it's tribal and it's like, it's about doing the right thing. It's not about doing kind of like particular ideology. Like, it's like, you need a wealth tax. I don't care the fuck who puts it in. There needs to be some redistributive, different structures need to be done. And it can get very combative when it's kind of like two sides warring, like, actually, there's a parliament. Just watch. It's like watching two gangs. It's just, you know, and I also kind of spent some time in kind of, you know, Like, I went to socialist stuff. I went to different Chomsky meetings. I would listen to Chomsky. But everyone would argue so much within themselves. Mm. It's like, because everyone identified as
the curse of the left, yeah.
Of course, that's my background. So I think I've got to denounce you, comrade.
Well, you grew up with that, right? You grew up in, like, a very kind of, like, you know, your parents are both Marxists, like proper Marxists.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think all of those ideas are really, really useful. I think the only way that they get... They can get a bit toxic is when it becomes oppositional.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oppositional. Yeah. It's just like then nobody has ever changed their mind when you've presented them with a big argument and they go, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just absolutely disassemble my entire personality and perspective and I'll take on that point of view. You know, the right, anyone from the right or conservative is like,
That's just kind of dispiriting thing, apart to some extent. There's not arguing, but it is a dispiriting thing of like human psychology in a sense, I suppose, isn't it? That you see, I'm looking at, like, Owen Jones put up a video of him arguing with that horrible little monster, Natasha Hausdorff from UK Lawyers for Israel. And, you know, she says, you know, there is no genocide. And he proves conclusively that there is, you know, the International Umar Bartov, the Israeli genocide scholars, this is a genocide, the international, you know, and, you know, it's irrefutable. But I mean, on one level, I think, how can you listen? How can you... And it kind of proves what you're saying in a sense, I suppose. How can you listen to your arguments being so comprehensively disassembled and still hang on to them, really?
Yeah, because it's tribal. Because the way that our brain works is it really has an in-group and an out-group. And while I think that used to work parliamentarily and you could have a debate, these days, especially with the harnessing of social media, that really kind of harnesses your amygdala and your fear response to it's them and there's us and there's all of this. Like, as soon as you've got a tribal sense of who you are, then you don't actually listen to the argument. You actually, the way the brain works is really interesting because the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is actually not the decision maker. That your emotion is the decision maker. And what your brain does is it actually is like the press secretary. It figures it out afterwards. It's like, you know, the look that the Trump's press secretary has every so often.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, I've got to justify what he's just done.
Yeah.
And that is essentially what our brain is doing. It's justifying an emotional position that we already have. And like, we think we're having an argument, but really we're trying to justify our own already entrenched emotional position. And I think, like, to be able to just unpick that and kind of say it means that, oh, suddenly everybody's aware that they've got a bit of the truth. And that we've got to come together and figure out what that is together.
Mm.
Because I just don't think anybody has monopoly on the truth, but also it's like there's more that unites us than divides us, you know, and that can often not become the case when people are arguing ideologically.
Oh. So have you defied nature by not having a tribe? What's your...
Still like absolutely I'm a Jesuit. No, I'm not. I suppose... The thing is, I'm aware of my own bias, but I try to have a bit of the space for it. But it's impossible, isn't it? It's like one thing that I try and do is I do recognize the difference between me and you guys one on one, the human experience, and then everything's mediated through that's filmed. Because biologically, we're not built to be communicating with people we don't know.
Mm.
Like, we were brought up in tribes of 150.
Mm.
So, like, if you were having an actual debate with somebody, like, you have a lot of very visible shared values and you've got to get on with them in the tribe. You can't, you know, you can't kind of afford to just go both barrels at them in the way that you can on Twitter, you know, because that's going to have consequences. Whereas now... There's a different way that I might speak to you guys in person without something recorded. And there's a different way where I think being recorded, I think it's really important to almost lean away from kind of emotional belief and lean towards kind of anything that can be a bit more broken down or is a bit less emotive.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, really, people then respond emotionally. And it becomes, I think it just, especially with social media, it just becomes so negative. It's like because the algorithm is incentivized for the profit motive to make you angry, to make you annoyed. That's a business model. you know, to keep you on the platform,
yes,
to press the amygdala, to get you responding, you know. It's like, it really is a extreme Kafkaesque.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, do you see yourself as being part of a political struggle? I mean, where would you locate yourself in?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that makes me less kind of ideological is because I didn't grow up in an ideological way. So, like, I grew up in, like, my mum and dad, right, don't vote Labour. Why don't they vote Labour? Because my mum's dad voted Labour and he was a bad guy. You know? My mum has a Boris Johnson mug. Now, Boris Johnson, she loves him, right? Boris Johnson, very sweet or whatever. But, like, none of the policies of the Conservative Party have ever helped them.
Yeah.
It's just that they don't engage with politics. Like, there's a whole mass of people that don't engage in politics in the way that I, who was lucky enough to be educated, like, can engage in politics. Most people, it's from a gut level, it's from who's around them, it's what I see on social media. And so partly the reason why I stay less ideological is so I can talk to my parents, so I can talk to people like my parents. Because if I take one side or the other demonstrably, I alienate half the people that I could be talking to. And I don't want to leave them behind. Like, I get very emotional when I talk about my family. Because it's like, they just never got, I'm so lucky to have got the chance that I did. Like, it's purely the grammar school. I went to the grammar school, they presumed I'd go to university.
Right, yeah. You
know, and I would never have done. You know, I'd be working at Burger King still. I might be running a Burger King, but I'd just like, here is something.
Yeah. It's the money.
That's just minimum wage. It's not,
you know. Even if you're running it.
I don't know. I never, it's all franchised.
Yeah. Oh, right.
It's not like, it's not too different.
Yes, bizarrely, when I was in the Maoist group, in Liverpool, one of the guys later on, he was American, but he later went on to be one of the big noises in McDonald's. Bizarre.
Oh, yeah.
He applied that knowledge of Marxist Leninist thought to McDonald's. Yeah, bizarre.
Those two things coming together.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is interesting for me, I suppose, because I've got a book coming out in September.
Yep. Link in the description to pre-order.
Is it called Walking Down the Street?
It's How I've Tried to Change the World by Walking Down the Middle of the Street Shouting. But it's about, I use some of those, I think some of the aspects that I talk about Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance, and I just talk about the illusory truth effect and stuff like that. But one of the things I'm trying to figure out is, when I go on the publicity round, is how to deal with, to say something different in a kind of, I have to go up against Melanie Phillips or Natasha Hausdorff, or, you know, even not necessarily somebody who's a Zionist, but, you know, how to try and bring something different to the party. So what you're saying is really, I'm impressed by people like Owen Jones or who's the Zeti API?
Medias.
Yeah, all the facts and, you know, they, you know, I mean, but I would, so I'm trying to think of doing something different, because I can't do that. I'm not interested in research on that level.
Yeah.
You know, bring the receipts. I've lost the receipts. They're in my other trousers. So I'm never going to be able to do that. So I'm trying to think about how you can evolve. And I suppose in the broader sense, evolve a kind of way of political discourse in the media where you say something, you know, you kind of, you're never going to convince Melanie Phillips because she's a fucking, a Jewish supremacist. But, you can at least convince the viewer, I suppose.
She's like, what? For like that very thing, I just think there's so much power to name the structure. So,
right,
like in that situation, say Melanie Phillips, it's you and Melanie Phillips, right? That dynamic, it's been set up as a debate, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to convince her of anything.
No.
It's like, if you manage to convince her of your point of view, she gets sacked.
There was
no way that she's going to take on anything you said. When you say something, she's going to just be regurgitating what she kind of like, you know, and that's the way that any debate works.
Yeah.
And so there's a fakeness to the whole situation. Because anyone that's watching is literally going to take sides, whether they believe in you or believe in her. And so I think there's great power in naming the whole fake structure, which is an entertainment structure,
right,
not a debate structure. Like, this has all been set up in order to have one side talking about the other side, but nobody's going to be convinced here.
And yeah,
actually, that this whole, you know, that divide and conquer, it's, yeah, that, it's that whole kind of, almost, I think might be also tied to the treatise of your book, which is essentially, you know, that there is walking down, shouting in the street, but actually the nuances of it are actually a lot more kind of structural, or there are other things.
No, they're more complicated. More, yeah, complicated. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It almost like would be an opportunity to talk about kind of how kind of the temptation to shout at that, at least let's
be, yeah, so strong. Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
You fucking, like, that. Fuck, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'd love to talk to her about moral licensing. Do you know what moral licensing is? So moral licensing is something that I always think about when I look at Israel, but I look at any I suppose, damaged or victimized aggressor. So often what moral licensing is if you believe in the greater good for what you are, like for Israel, it's about protection. It's about, we're fighting for our land and everyone around us is against us. Now, moral licensing is a thing where when you know that your cause is good, like, because nobody's saying Israel shouldn't exist, you know, but when you know that your cause is right.
No one on that side of the table is.
But it's interesting though, because it also cuts both ways in that. It's like you wouldn't want to kind of, like, you know, just to wipe out the...
No one's saying that there, any Jews need to die.
Exactly.
Or, yeah, no,
exactly.
We're not trying to endanger them.
Right. So, yeah. But, you know, to use that distinction, nobody's saying anyone needs to die. But the... From there, from when the moral licensing on the on the Israeli side is that, well, we know our cause is right. Therefore, any action that we take on that behalf, then it licenses morally what we do.
Yeah.
And you also get it on the left as well. Like, you can also have it where people, like, are so, find it so abhorrent what is happening in Palestine. They almost will negative things to happen to Israelis. You know, and it's very hard on both sides not to kind of morally license kind of unfair attack on innocence. You know, it's just so, like, I'd love to talk to her about moral licensing.
Yeah.
It's a psychological effect that you can just say, so how do you feel about this? Because, like, this is an effect. And so do you feel like you are in any way, you've got any of that? Because it must be happening for you because you're under attack from all these other places, you know. Like, do you not think you might be biased in that way? What have you put in place to ensure that kind of that isn't happening? Because I bet they don't have that many structures in place.
No. Well, I think she'd be very difficult to shift. But yeah, I mean, yes. I've been thinking about that. Yeah, anyway, I think that is the way to say something new and different and interesting is when you're confronted by those people. Because I can't do that. Owen Jones thing is to exactly say what you're saying. I'd be, yeah.
I mean, I look at any of them, just like, I just can't, I couldn't conjugate thought in as much. I don't have the facts to my, like, not, I don't need, yeah, like, say, don't have the receipt.
No.
So you'd have to just lead from emotion, from your heart, and from your humanity. And maybe it is a good idea just to bypass this false debate you've been set up and just talk to the camera.
But I think you have actually thought structurally as you have about thought, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, where do you see the world go? I mean, how do you see your project? And
let's pick up that question in a second. I have a bit of admin to do as we're like halfway through the show.
All right.
Okay. Just to tell the listeners at home and the viewers on our Patreon, we know this show normally comes out on Saturday mornings. There's going to be a bit of scheduling issues over the coming weeks. And also we did Wellingborough last Saturday, so that didn't come out till Monday. And then I'm off traveling next week for work for a couple of weeks. We're going to try and keep putting one out once a week, but it might not be on Saturday. So apologies, people at home, if that's messing with your schedules.
I get messages when it doesn't drop on Saturday morning. They're like, where's the podcast? I need it for my drive to this place or that place. You know, I do it at this time every week. So sorry, folks, but we are going to endeavor to put one out every week in the next few weeks until things return to normal. And please, if you're enjoying the show, go to our Patreon and support it financially. Throw us a few quid a month. It means a great deal. It keeps us in business. Go to patreon.com/AlexisCell podcast. You can watch full video episodes and you can see this lovely setup we have here at the Bill Murray, and using Barry and his team and his three cameras and sound and everything. We put all the full video episodes and they come out early on there, earlier than Audio Boom, most of the time. We have Alexi Reacts every week, where Alexi watches old shit he's done and reacts to it. We have other videos and bits and bobs and lovely chat rooms up there. So go to patreon.com/AlexisCell podcast to support the show. And that's all my admin. Alexi, what were you just asking?
Hang on, Alexi Reacts. So do you remember it all?
Yeah.
If I had to react to stuff that I was doing in my 20s, I'd be like, oh, that is me.
He doesn't remember every detail, but he has really good insights to it. And
yeah, no, it's a really good aid memoir. And I've never done it until I've been forced to do it, really. So, yeah, to look at, stuff comes back, really. I think it's all in there somewhere,
Yeah. What's here is stuff. It was so good. I grew up on it. It was so funny.
It's brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. Like, it was one of the formative, like, there are a few people that kind of formative kind of comedy kind of influences.
Yeah.
It really was. Like, and, you know.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying, because I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything Alexis does. So I'm really enjoying discovering things, especially with the man himself, to get to tell me some insights. And it's still holds up so much. Fucking funny.
Yeah, no, I think it was. I mean, it's a show that doesn't get, partly because it presents a complex viewpoint. Yeah. It gets ignored, but it was more popular in its day than the fast show.
It's like, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's a show that's slightly fallen between the cracks. So
I find that interesting culturally. Like, we had Ruby Wax in, right? Ruby Wax was massive, absolutely huge, right?
Yeah.
And she's going on tour. She's interviewed Donald Trump.
Yeah,
which is an incredible interview. He hates her.
Yeah,
you just see that Trump you see now. She's like, absolutely, and she really gets under her skin despite trying to like it, be liked, right?
Right.
And then Zsa Zsa Gabor and all this. But you realize culturally what the culture likes to remember or what it doesn't like to remember, and it doesn't like to remember it's almost like inconvenient things, or doesn't.
Right,
that with the Russell Brand stuff? You know, the shit stuff, Russell Brand, what an absolute shit of a man, right?
Yeah.
And everyone goes, oh, he's a monster. But nobody remembers that all of the cultural, like the BBC,
he's really astute.
Everyone's just going, oh, isn't he a wag? Isn't he this? He was like the son, the
top kind of shagger.
Top shagger of the week. Mm. Like, they were literally on the abuse boat with him, and then something happens to him and everyone's like, oh, I didn't know. As if they're not complicit in it. I just find that cultural, it's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah,
it's just that culture. Really never gets spoken about.
And it's it's so dangerous, because when Russell Brand was at his peak, and that was very encouraged so openly, it was his audience were like teen boys, and like, no wonder we've ended up where we are now with this manosphere nonsense, all this misogyny that is like, you'd think with PC gone mad and woke nonsense that it wouldn't be the worst time for misogyny we've ever seen. But like, it's maybe not the worst, but in certain demographics for sure, you know, it's so surprising. But it was encouraged not that long ago, 15 years ago.
No, well, it hasn't really ever gone away. It's like, it just, we conveniently forget it. But stuff is one of the things I loved about it is kind of, it was so interesting. It came from different environments, perspectives. It brought different perspectives in. Like, part of my education as a comedian was yourself, Bill Hicks, and George Carlin. People are actually talking about ideas and kind of, like, literally there would have been stuff that you would have talked about that I would have gone off and read, and I didn't even know.
Yeah.
Like, likewise with Bill Hicks, like, you know, getting into whoever, mm-hmm. Terence McKenna or, you know, anyone at Noam Chomsky. He mentioned Chomsky. What do you call himself? Chomsky with dick jokes. But or George Carlin, and he referenced those things. So, you know, like, you never really can see your own influence.
Yeah.
Like, that was like,
lucky yeah. That really yeah. No, well, thank you. Wouldn't. Yeah. No. It's true. And it's the simple stuff that, yeah, that was promoted in the culture is wallowed in, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just too fucking good.
But then we've all got hubris.
Yeah. No, but in my case, it's in. I'm the exception, the prisoner. Yes, I actually haven't finished watching it yet, but I saw you did a podcast about Mark Thomas changed the tax laws. I felt uncomfortable about you promoting another comedian.
Well, come on. You know what? When you're doing the book and you want to promote the book, so what I would do, I'd love to have you on the channel because I'd love to talk to you about some of the structural stuff. And I'd probably look at some of the stuff and go, oh, that's interesting. And then what I do is I often interview and then take that out and look at different studies that show things. So I'd love to do that.
Yeah, no, we definitely.
There you go.
My people will be.
Hello.
No, not you, the real people. The people at the giant. Yeah. People at the giant conglomerate, the publishers.
Oh, the good people, yeah.
So, well, so we were talking about, where next, as it were.
I don't know. So where next? Really, I suppose, you know, there's that old John Lennon quote, God wants, if you want to make God laugh, show me your plans. But I'm really loving making the videos themselves, like people go, hey, you know, I often get comments, hey, you mentioned about one of these out a week, how's it this in depth? But it's 30 years of ideas. It's like 30 years of stuff that I've never really had a platform to do. Mm. Like, you know, like I struggled in comedy mostly because I was having to do two jobs and survive, and you know, you just can't do it. You've not got enough money coming in. So yeah. I ended up kind of made some Edinburgh shows and did it. But you know, like you go to Edinburgh and you can be critically successful, but you're still playing to four people, you know. So all of these ideas are ideas that I've written for years. So I'm just absolutely delighted to be writing them, forming them, and having people kind of watch them. I really see my motivation. I find great meaning in kind of trying in my head to speak to people like my family, because I think like it's one of the, you know, like the, what's it called? Your superpowers or also your disabilities.
Right.
You know, like, I struggled for a long time because I come from the background they come from, but it also gives me insight to the fact that actually I can talk to anyone from any kind of, you know, any background. And so part of the mission of what I'm kind of want to do is just how can I put these ideas in a way that aren't kind of, they're not personal. It's not about kind of me being right. It's just about spreading ideas, which are actually scientific research. And can lead to a better world.
Yeah. You
know, because it's like...
Wouldn't that be nice if we could get, you know, make some progress on that?
Because things are clear. It's like even power. Like, you give somebody power. I was listening to Varys Flacker talking about this on The Rest Is Politics the other day. And he was talking about one of the sadnesses in his life is watching his fellow people that he grew up with and shared views with get into power.
Yes.
And then become monsters.
Well, that's one of the first examples of that, wasn't it? The leader of his party was called Tsipras, and he led, and Varoufakis was the economics minister, and they this overtly left-wing government, and then the IMF threatened them, and he brought in economic conditions for Greece which were more severe than the IMF had demanded. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a classic case of that, exactly that.
And it's like there's real a lot, so much study about having power reduces the empathy, your ability to be able to feel what other people feel.
Right.
So whatever your background, I mean, this is on average, there might be the odd exception, whatever, you know, but as an average, what happens is that the more power and the more money you have, you can't feel what other people feel, you know? And so therefore, yes, power should be really limited, and it should be limited.
Yes, absolutely.
To,
yeah.
To kind of, and in structure and
maybe. That's why we need anarchism, isn't it? You know,
yeah, well, there should be some kind of, you know, collective kind of filtering through lots of other people, or, you know, or a non-elected kind of body that just kind of takes people randomly from different socioeconomic groups so that they can, you know, throw an idea around rather than just being the laws, or, you know, but like, so yeah, I kind of.
Yeah, no, I think that's, well, you make a powerful argument. Yeah, I'd like to see that in my, you know, before, well, in my lifetime, really.
You talk a lot about how governing should, we should really break down to the local level and your party.
Yeah, because, I mean, growing up in revolutionary politics, I've absolutely seen the way that which even tiny amounts of power sends people crazy, really.
He does. Really does.
Yeah. It's funny because you mentioned Boris Johnson before, and where your pub is, the Bill Murray, is just up the road from Boris Johnson. Used to live on Colebrook Road.
Yeah.
Just by the bridge. And my friend also lived on Colebrook Road. She was kept awake at night by people screaming at his house. just as they went past, you know, and bicycles and cars. Can't. Yeah.
You fucking.
It was every, I remember there was that, yeah, there was for a while, there was always a crowd outside that house. He's, I don't know where he lives now, but
it's the same place, actually, Colebrook Road, that Douglas Adams used to live
on. Oh, I know, well, I know, yeah, New Douglas.
You know, I was just around, I was walking back from a gig 2 days ago, and I walked past George Orwell's house, which is on Canterbury Square. His old George Orwell's old house up the road as well.
In fact, Douglas was on Drunken Terrace or Drunken Terrace.
Yeah, Drunken Terrace. Drunken
Terrace.
Did you go there? Did you go to his house?
Yeah, I knew Douglas. Yeah, I was really, it was really, because I wrote this book of short stories, and he wrote, gave me this amazing review in the Observer, saying, I know Alexis House slightly, but I didn't realise that he could write these books of extraordinary kind of sensitivity and intelligence, and then he died.
Yeah,
it's just my fucking luck.
He was too sensitive.
He was a funny. Well, I knew him because I mean it's one of the kind of the oddnesses of my life in a sense that because of the people I found myself mixing with. That Oxford group, like Douglas and that, I mean, obviously lesser lights, like Angus Steaton and
Stephen Fry
and all those people. And sort of, I mean, I actually wrote, my first novel was about a guy who, this entire friendship group is killed in a car crash.
Overtaken.
Because I felt like I was living the wrong life in a way. So I sort of, weirdly, and I felt I didn't fit in with them really, you know. And so, I mean, you know, and I mean, Douglas was lovely, yeah. But I sort of kind of felt, you know, every Christmas he'd do magical singing Christmases. It's like
magical, what's
magical? No, magical. It's magical.
Like they're all
you're singing in Latin, I think.
Everyone does that, right? Everyone does that. My mum and dad would do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. But I gradually kind of extracted myself from that group.
Of they were the enemy, like you told your young ones' castmates.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Really? What?
Well, no, it's the story. When we did Bambi, you know, the University Challenge episode, the young ones, I pre-recorded my bit as a train driver. And when I just came in to see the studio recording. And
had Stephen Fry, Emma Thompson,
Hugh Laurie,
and
Mel Smith and Griffiths Jones all in it. And I said to Zisa, what are these people doing here? I thought they were all the enemy.
Yeah.
And she said, no, that was just you. she likes those people.
I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, I've simplified it slightly, but yeah, I thought we all agreed that we hated like Stephen. It turned out it was only me. So what do you see? I mean, in terms of politics, what how do you...
How do we get out of this hole?
Somebody asked us in Wellingborough, yeah, do you feel any... Is there a grounds for hope, do you think?
You know, I do think there's grounds for hope. I really do. And I also, I think part of the reason why I think there's grounds for hope is like when I put out video, and like I'm not the biggest channel in the world, but it's growing and I'm so grateful for it. It's like the amount of comments on it, and it's so positive. And I think that a lot of where people get news from these days is algorithm and it's online. And I think people are quite sick of the combative, actually kind of rage baiting content that's being thrown up.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do see that there's when you get too much of one thing, then it creates a great open space for something else.
Yeah.
And I really do see a lot of really positive, engaged, intelligent, interested people that just don't want what's kind of
No, and of course they never had any before. Well, you know, before Zach, before the Greens, they never had a way to express that politically. Yeah. Did they? Well, Corbyn, but
yeah. Are you guys hopeful? I mean, I feel as well that we're like you. I don't tend to think that I know the way things will go. Like you know that thing of like I can't remember. But it's like if you look at your own stuff and you do what's right in your own field, that everything else looks after itself. It's not anarcho-syndicalist in a way, or however you say it, but it's like you like everybody, a temporary autonomous zone, everybody works within kind of like their own field and does that with integrity. Right. And then everything kind of sorts itself out. It's like the way the body works, right? The body, your heart isn't going, I've got to get the rest of the body going, I've got to keep it going. It just... Every cell does what it's meant to do. Mm-hmm. And then you get this kind of emergent property of everything else working. And I'm quite hopeful that I can't see the big picture, but the fact that I'm able to talk about these things is getting an audience. I just think, I'm not leveraging anything. I'm not being cynical with it. I'm not trying to over advertise. I'm not putting a lot of money behind it. Like I think that's quite hopeful in itself, you know?
To me, it always seems like a rate. There used to be like an arcade game where it was like very old fashioned Victorian kind of, where you would like it was horses and they were on slots and you'd wind it.
Yeah.
I think it's like there's two horses. One is the forces of darkness and obliteration, and the other is the side we're on. The our horse is called the vision of fairness and light, and it's like. The forces of darkness wind faster, and then we find, and I think it's a kind of it's that kind of like edging ahead and then falling behind. And so I think we're in the fight. I think it's, do you believe in evil? I mean, do you think?
No, I think that, I suppose
that's a big question. Talking about racehorses, and then
I flip. I mean, you know, like these are questions that I kind of do think over a lot. But like even those two horses, I would look at say dual or non-dual stuff, the kind of stuff that Alan Watts would kind of talk about. It's like one creates the other that creates the other.
Right.
And I think that they're one, like if it's a race, like I think that then I think there's a possibility right now that instead of it being kind of us giving kind of too much power to our tribal brains that mankind historically has grown up with. I think there's actually a chance now that we look at things a little bit more analytically and build a system that takes our biases and goes, all right, and we need to correct there for that, and we need to correct there for that, because we've got too much power. Yeah. So it's like there's too much power in our ape brains. There's that phrase, we've got the bodies of apes, but the power of atomic kind of superheroes.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just a recipe for monkey with guns.
Right? Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, you know, at some point people are going, let's take the guns away from the monkeys, right? And I'm the monkey in this.
I hope you're right. I mean,
I was at drinks last night. We did a rehearsed reading of a play in a theatre a shout out Stratford East Royal Theatre, and we were sat around the table in the pub afterwards, and everyone, we were having this discussion about what's to come. Everyone apart from me was certain that Farage would be the next prime minister.
Wow.
And I know that's a very common thing. Everyone, a lot of people, they're not alone. My brother thinks it, you know, a lot of my friends think it's a sure-in. Of course it's going to happen. And I was the only one there going, do none of you think at all there's a chance?
Mm.
And then if not, then what's the fucking point? Why are we still trying to fight the good fight? I was like, if you don't think it's possible, then why are we bothering at all? Like, I have to think it's possible, if not even likely, that good will prevail, and we'll have a leader who believes in humanity and justice. And otherwise, why are we fucking bothering? You know, why do I do this podcast? Why do I go and try and convince people? Why do I go on the marches if I don't think there's a fucking chance?
Well, I think
of something good happening.
I mean, I think what you saw in Gorton and Denton, for instance, was that the left vote coalesced around, you know, people understand the threat of reform and they'll vote green.
Yeah.
I mean, not the stinking Labour Party, but green in order to keep them.
That's who we have at the moment. Yeah. You know, is the Green Party. Yeah.
We're also recording this on May the 7th.
Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, yeah, a very significant.
Remember that, was it Brewster's Millions? None of the above. Can you remember the none of the above quote thing in so Brewster's Millions is the concept where he's inherits all this money, but he's got to spend it in order to get all the rest of the money.
Yeah.
And he's not allowed to have anything left at the end. And so one of the things he runs for office, because that's the best way to lose money.
Right? Oh,
but he didn't want to win, because if he wins, then he's got this money. So he had a thing where he would vote, he wanted you to vote for none of the above. Just like, that's my party, the none of the above party. And it started like really taking off. Like, oh Christ, that's too popular. Yeah. But there is at the moment, it's very kind of like with reform, everybody's kind of like, no, anyone but. You just have anyone but?
Yeah. Yeah,
but he's a I get very kind of hopeful though, because you've got to run for the bus. Like the only option is to try.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only option, and you never know. And the other thing I realize is I've been doing this monologue on the Closure Act at the moment, and how so many people were forced off their land into the factories by the job creators. Of the people that happen to know people like in Parliament, they will create factories and, you know, well, we've created a job for you. It's 14 hours standing up and you don't do it, you starve. All right, well, I guess I'll do that job then. Thank you for creating that job.
Yeah.
But we don't see all of those lives that actually fell by the wayside as part of, you know, like that really died in suffering, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, humanity does continue. And I do think that, like, though I'd like to think that those people didn't die in vain, because it brought humanity to other people around them. And I think that even if there is suffering, it can bring us humanity. That's what I hope, anyway. Like, I mean, you know, we've got to run for the bus.
Yeah, well, Zizek talks about, we were talking about this on Saturday as well. Yeah, the communes, yeah, communism. I couldn't do it.
Oh, no.
In the end, for health reasons, Yeah, I was supposed to be doing it last night. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Did you know I'm doing?
No, not at all. No, it's just,
No.
But yes, I mean, communes, you know. I mean, it's all about an alternative to capitalism as well, isn't it? You know, being wage slavery and I've lost the train of thought, really.
and also, I would say there's huge hope in you guys. There's huge hope in you carrying on as well. And just like the whole lineage, your whole, like, we are proof of hope. I survived. Like, you know, like there is so much hope in the fact that we're still, like Rocky, stood up.
Yeah.
I haven't gone down yet. It's just like, just keep getting punched in the face. But yeah.
Fuck yeah, man.
Yes, it's true. It is easy to become, I think on the darkest days, we did become pessimistic, really. But yeah. It's important to retain hope, I think.
Yeah, well, the hope is that we're here. Like, you know, we don't have to believe in it. We just have to do it.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll end it there. Barry, thank you very, very much. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.